This is Encounter on VOA. Here's Carol Castillo.
Welcome to Encounter on the Voice of America. On this year-end edition of the program, we bring you highlights from 2022. Hello again, I'm Carol Castiel. Russia's unprovoked invasion of Ukraine on February 24 was a major topic for many Encounter programs throughout the year. On one show, we discussed accountability for alleged war crimes and crimes against humanity perpetrated by Moscow, which apparently targeted civilians and civilian infrastructure in Ukraine. According to the Committee on Security and Cooperation in Europe, quote, the withdrawal of Russian troops from towns like Bucha, Chernihiv, and Sumy has revealed horrific scenes of civilian carnage, mass graves, and reports of rape and torture, unquote. In addition to these specific war crimes, my two guests on the April 17 edition of Encounter suggest that the Russian invasion itself is a crime of aggression and should also be prosecuted, not unlike what happened in Nuremberg after World War II. My guests were Alex Whiting, visiting professor of practice at Harvard Law, and the current deputy specialist prosecutor at the Kosovo Specialist Prosecutor's Office in The Hague, and Michael Newton, professor of law and political science at Vanderbilt University in the state of Tennessee. Alex Whiting advocates for the creation of a separate hybrid court since the ICC, International Criminal Court, does not have jurisdiction.
As Mike said, the crime of aggression was the motivating central crime at Nuremberg. War crimes and crimes against humanity were also prosecuted, but the real mover of the Nuremberg case was the crime of aggression. But no international tribunal has prosecuted a case of aggression since Nuremberg, and the ICC only recently got jurisdiction over the crime of aggression, but it doesn't apply in this case because of a particular jurisdictional provision that only applies to that crime. And so the ICC cannot prosecute the crime of aggression. But because this is such a clear case of aggression, there are serious discussions underway about creating a separate court that would be able to prosecute that crime based on Ukraine's jurisdiction. The idea is a court that would be a kind of hybrid international court that would be an agreement between Ukraine and several states or the European Union or maybe the United Nations. All these ideas are being bounced around. And that would be a remarkable development because it would allow the prosecution of what is a very clear act of aggression in this case. But it would also be historically very significant to have another major prosecution of aggression and resurrect this crime, which, as I said, since Nuremberg has never been prosecuted.
Michael Newton, what are your thoughts regarding this crime of aggression and how to address it, since the ICC can't do it in this particular case?
Well, I really think we're at a watershed, with particularity for the crime of aggression, but also I think for the larger integrity of the field of international criminal justice, whether we want to talk about war crimes deliberately committed on a massive scale against civilians or ongoing crimes against humanity. There's an old piece of literature that Robert Jackson, the American prosecutor at Nuremberg, used to quote. He would say, "Grant us grace to fearlessly contend against evil." And in that context, then the idea is that aggression is the macro crime that carries within it the seeds of all of these other crimes. And for that reason, I think you're seeing a watershed. You're seeing political ramifications in the United Nations. You're seeing realignments in world politics. And Alex is right. It'll be remarkable to create a separate process to address what is absolutely a violation of the most fundamental principle of international law, which is enshrined in Article 2 of the UN Charter. The idea that the use of transnational force against states is limited to those very clear legal principles, and you can't abuse those.
Experts Alex Whiting and Michael Newton on holding Russia accountable for war crimes in and the crime of aggression against Ukraine. Turning from Ukraine to turmoil inside Iran, women-led protests erupted in the Islamic Republic after the death of 22-year-old Mahsa Amini in mid-September. Authorities claimed that the young Kurdish woman was detained by the government's morality police for failing to properly wear a mandatory hijab to cover her hair. Amini's death has sparked unrest and protests, which have triggered a deadly crackdown by Iran's police. led by young Iranians fed up with the ultra-conservative dress code, coupled with deep disgust over economic mismanagement and corruption, the protest morphed into a nationwide uprising against the clerical regime. Director of the Iran Project at the Middle East Institute, Alex Vatanka, says that despite the fact that Iranian women have been protesting against the mandatory hijab since the inception of the Islamic Republic in 1979, this time is different.
So you've had anger against this mandatory hijab, as I said, for as long as the Islamic Republic has been around. What's different this time around, it seems to me, is this new generation of Iranian, particularly Iranian women. But let's not forget, these Iranian women are backed up by Iranian men in this quest to get rid of this, not just the hijab. Essentially, what they want is the abolishment of a regime that very clearly a tiny minority, about 15% of Iranians, have any regard for, the Islamic Republic. So this younger generation of Iranians, and the data speaks for itself. And I'm just going to give you some data from the Iranian regime itself. So this is not data from me or anyone outside of Iran. These are figures that the regime produces. Most of the people who are protesting right now are in the age of 15 to 25 group. This is a generation that not only dislikes the mandatory hijab or all sorts of other rules that the regime imposes on society, but it's a generation that is willing to fight for it. And that's the difference. This is a radical, if you will, generation. And that has caught the regime by surprise. And frankly, as we speak right now, the authorities in Iran have no idea what to do with this regime. They are pretty sure that this anger is not going to go anywhere. And if they suppress the protesters today, they're going to come back again next week, next month, next year. They don't have a solution, because if they start actually having compromises with the people who are protesting right now, it would be very evident to anyone who watches Iran that the system would have to go, because that's basically what the protest is about. It's not about the hijab per se. It's one issue that people care about, but the list of grievances against the regime is very long. Ayatollah Khamenei, the supreme leader at the top, knows that, and that's why he's so reluctant to start that dialogue with his own people.
For her part, Laura Rosen reminded that the international talks over reviving the nuclear deal with Iran had been at an impasse. She compared Tehran's uncertainty about how to close the nuclear deal with its paralysis regarding the widespread protests.
It's interesting that there's a kind of paralysis on the Iranian side on going forward with the nuclear deal. And I think it's similar to the kind of paralysis we see in their lack of certainty of how to respond to the protests. And so for the U.S. policymakers trying to figure out what to do, they were already going to have to figure out, what are we going to do if we're not going to get a nuclear deal? And I think in a way, the fact that there's no nuclear deal to try to get through Congress to have to sign off on, they can lean into the protests more than we might have seen at earlier points. You know, we've seen the U.S. administration, from President Biden in a statement, Secretary of State Blinken, all the spokespeople for the White House and the State Department talk about how they admire these women and girls, that these people should have their rights. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman, who was very involved in the nuclear negotiations for the Obama administration, spoke with technology companies to try to assure them of the loosening of sanctions so they can get technology to Iranian people so they can communicate better and protect themselves from surveillance. So without the U.S. trying to say, we're backing regime change, they've tried to give their rhetorical support and through the use of sanctions their support to the people on the streets.
Laura Rosen on Washington's response to the uprising in Iran. Following months of protests set off by the death of Mahsa Amini, who was held by the morality police, by early December, Tehran announced it would abolish the force. It remains to be seen, however, if this partial concession will in fact be implemented, and if so, if it will mollify the protesters whose demands had grown into a full-throated call for the downfall of the Islamic regime. Now let's take a break. You are listening to The Best of Encounter 2022 on The Voice of America. I'm Carol Castiel. Here's a reminder that Encounter is available for free download from our website, voanews.com/encounter, and from many streaming websites such as Apple Podcasts. We also hope that you'll get in touch with us through either Facebook at Carol Castiel VOA, all one word, Twitter at Carol_Castiel, or by sending us an email to encounter@voanews.com. Now let's get back to our program featuring the highlights of Encounter in 2022. We now turn to Latin America. The continent's largest and most powerful country, Brazil, held a runoff presidential election in November, which resulted in victory for leftist opposition leader and former president Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva and in defeat for populist right-wing president Jair Bolsonaro. Bruna Santos, senior advisor at the Brazil Institute at the Wilson Center, and Eric Farnsworth, vice president for the America Society and Council of the Americas, weighed in on the global significance of Lula's win. Here is Bruna Santos reacting to the election results in what has become a deeply polarized nation, not unlike the United States.
I have to say it was the most bitterly fought election in Brazilian democratic history. And I think that the conclusion is that democracy was the winner. As you said, Jair Bolsonaro and Luiz Inácio Lula da Silva were the leading figures of a confrontation that left behind a divided country. And we have to say that Lula won by a margin that's not that big for Brazil. It's 2 million votes. And we saw throughout the campaign a number of cases of violence, fake news, and other threats to Brazilian democracy. As you also mentioned at the beginning, the silence of Bolsonaro was also a problem because his silence somehow gave room for his supporters to erect hundreds of roadblocks and strikes all over the country. And it's still happening. I mean, he came out on camera and called people to stop it, but always leaving room for ambiguity, like saying, oh, I'm also angry, but you should not follow the same recipes of the left when you are going on the streets and contesting the results. So I think Lula has many challenges ahead. And most importantly, Bolsonarismo as a movement came out of this election much stronger than it was before.
Despite the populist movement that Bolsonaro helped to foment, part of his policy will change drastically under Lula. Eric Farnsworth said that the international community greatly welcomes Lula's commitment to preserving the Amazon. Bolsonaro engaged in extensive deforestation by encouraging an increase in farming, ranching, and mining therein.
Brazil is the sovereign nation over the vast majority of the Amazon. It's not the only country, but certainly controls the vast majority of it. Therefore, Brazilian domestic policies have a global implication in terms of environmental context. And that maybe didn't used to be such a concern for many in the global community until we became much more aware of the impact of global climate change and the impact of virgin forest on the pace of change. And so this is a critically important issue now from the global perspective. And so if you have a choice between presidents, one who, as part of their national economic policy, really wants to accelerate the deforestation versus one who is looking to decelerate, then that has a direct implication for global climate change policies. Of course, implementation is going to be key for President Lula. Rhetoric is easy to say, perhaps. Implementation is really difficult, particularly in a region as vast as the Amazon with illegal logging and various things. So that will require a very assiduous effort to implement those policies. The second piece I would add is one that I think is equally important in the context of implications for global interests, and that is Brazil is a continent-sized economy, of course, with widely divergent geographic and economic and social and racial contexts throughout the country. And yet, the country has proven itself capable of running a free and fair election where the results were known mere hours after the polls closed. This is really, really important, particularly in the context of social media, in the context of misinformation, intentional misinformation. Some people might call that fake news as a term of art. But the point is that it's become a lot more complicated these days just to run elections, to say nothing of running policy. That is in some ways an inspiration to larger economies around the world, including the United States. Because look, if you can't run a free and fair election, then democracy itself is called into question. If you can run a free and fair election, that is the baseline for democracies. And I think Brazil has just proven it can be done. And that's a really, really important thing.
Eric Farnsworth of the America Society and Council of the Americas on the global implications of Brazil's recent elections. Speaking of elections, the U.S. midterm elections were also held in November. As was expected, the opposition Republican Party won a narrow majority of seats in the House of Representatives, but the Democrats maintained control of the Senate. Here is how my guests, John Fortier and Jim Kessler, characterized the results for Republicans and Democrats.
It's definitely a disappointing result for Republicans. That being said, I mean, I think the big news, if they do take the House of Representatives, in a way is the more substantive news. It's not as good as Republicans wanted, but it will change dynamics of governing in Washington. And it will mean that we don't work off of the Joe Biden agenda. We have to argue things out, sometimes compromise, probably not as much legislation gets done, certainly not as much of the Biden agenda gets done. And there will be certainly much more oversight from Republicans on priorities of theirs rather than Democratic priorities and their view of the Biden administration's failings. I think that's still the big takeaway, even though it was a very disappointing night for Republicans.
Jim Kessler, turning to you, you and John have said ad nauseum at these microphones that midterms are usually a referendum on the president and his party, which usually get trounced. But you recently said that you thought this would be an election of choice. Why do you think Democrats defied the trend and the GOP failed to deliver the so-called red wave their leaders predicted?
I've never seen a race in which there was such a wide disparity in the quality of candidates between the two parties as this past midterm. And if you looked at the key races, particularly in the Senate and in a lot of the swing districts in the House, Democrats had really solid, moderate, mainstream candidates, and Republicans, through competitive primaries in which Donald Trump really put his thumb on the scale, were nominating people out of the mainstream. We're nominating really extreme candidates, a lot of whom were election deniers. So we have an election in which Democrats really beat expectations. And just to put it in perspective, going back to America's Civil War, 1865, the party in the White House has gained seats in the House only three times in a midterm out of 40 tries. Democrats aren't going to gain seats, but their losses are going to be in the single digits. And since the direct election of senators in 1914, the party in the White House has gained seats in a midterm seven out of 27 times. There's a pretty good chance Democrats will end up picking up a seat in the Senate. So this was a precedent-smashing election, particularly when you compare it to the other two times Bill Clinton and Barack Obama, the last two Democratic presidents, had their midterms. They lost a combined 117 House seats and 15 Senate seats. Just one more point, Carol. Where Republicans nominated mainstream candidates, they did well. In New Hampshire, for governor, Chris Sununu cruised to victory. In Georgia, Brian Kemp, Republican governor, cruising to victory. And in other places as well. So this was not just a victory for Democrats and a loss for Republicans. It was a loss for the Donald Trump wing of the Republican Party.
After the much-anticipated Senate runoff election in the state of Georgia, to which Jim Kessler alluded, Democrat Raphael Warnock defeated his Republican challenger, Herschel Walker, giving Democrats one extra seat in the Senate. With 51 seats, Democrats will enhance their influence in committees and alleviate the need for Vice President Kamala Harris to break tie votes. We close on a cautiously optimistic note regarding the civil war in Ethiopia and the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. After 2 years of fighting, which has killed thousands, displaced millions, and left hundreds of thousands on the brink of famine, the African Union in early November negotiated a cessation of hostilities agreement between the government in Addis Ababa and the TPLF, Tigray People's Liberation Front. My two guests were former U.S. ambassadors to Ethiopia, former Assistant Secretary of State for African Affairs, Tibor Naj, and Ambassador Donald Booth. I asked Ambassador Booth about the challenges and impediments that lay ahead and what it would take for the ceasefire to be sustainable.
Well, first of all, it's going to take the continued political will of both the Ethiopian government leadership and the Tigrayan leadership to implement what they have agreed on paper. I was pleased that the humanitarian assistance, which is so desperately needed in Tigray and in contiguous regions that have been affected by the conflict, has begun to move in recent days, and that the agreement that was signed on November 12th on implementation has addressed on a number of key points. But I still see some major issues looming. One of the provisions calls for the disarmament and demobilization of Tigrayan forces to occur in conjunction with the withdrawal of all forces other than that of the Ethiopian National Defense Force, which would mean the withdrawal of Eritrean forces, as well as ethnic militias from neighboring states, particularly from Amhara State. The Eritreans have, as far as I'm aware, remained completely silent on their intentions in this regard. And the issue of the Amhara withdrawing from the western part of what had been Tigray province, or the Tigrayans still considered to be Tigray province, is going to be another contentious issue that could indeed delay the disarmament process. I certainly hope not. I think the suffering that has been witnessed by the people of Tigray and the neighboring areas is such that the political leadership needs to get on with continuation of the cessation of hostilities and truly reaching a political solution.
Ambassador Donald Booth. I then asked Ambassador Naj what factors he thought led to this moment.
I think the protagonists finally came to the realization that there was not going to be a military solution. They were on the way to basically act two of this horrendous drama, because it started out the premeditated attack by the TPLF on the Ethiopian National Defense Forces, Ethiopians with Eritreans, and overwhelmed the cities in Tigray. The Tigrayans fled into the hills and then slowly retook most of Tigray and made a play for Addis Ababa. The Ethiopians beat them back and then slowly again started encroaching on Tigrayan territory, taking one town after another. So if that had kept going, I think it would have been replaying what happened before. And I think they came to that realization. Tigrayans were suffering terribly. The Ethiopian armed forces was not going to take all of Tigray, which is extremely, extremely difficult terrain to hold. So now I think the professional military leaders came to that realization, and they probably convinced their governments that they had to move forward. That's one of the really good things that I can say about this part of Africa. Both armed forces are disciplined and they follow the hierarchy, and the command structure will stay in place. So for me, that is encouraging moving forward.
Finally, Ambassador Donald Booth says for sustainable peace and stability in the Horn of Africa, the government and people of Ethiopia must address the root causes of the conflict, one of which is the nature of the Ethiopian state.
I think another unsettled issue in all of this is the nature of the Ethiopian state, and that's really what has been at the core of this conflict. Will it be a centralized state? Will Prime Minister Abiy's vision of a national party, the Prosperity Party, prevail, or will the concept of ethnic federalism prevail? It's interesting, in the peace agreement or in the cessation of hostilities, they agreed to the implementation of the Constitution, which would seem to imply an acceptance of ethnic federalism. But I doubt very much that that is what Addis had in mind when it agreed to that wording. So I think this debate will go on. I hope it will go on peacefully rather than through conflict. But Ethiopia has had a long history of strong central states, which are then challenged by the periphery, that then fight the periphery and in the process weaken themselves. And then the state has to be rebuilt again. It would very much be in the interests of the people of the Horn of Africa, Ethiopia in particular, but also of the United States, and I think all peace-loving countries, that stability could be restored and the process of economic development and economic growth could be returned to Ethiopia.
Ambassador Donald Booth, former U.S. ambassador to Ethiopia. At year's end, President Biden hosted heads of government and delegations from approximately 49 countries for the second U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit, the goal of which is to deepen bilateral cooperation, especially in the area of trade and investment. Washington intends to signal to Africa that, in contrast to China and Russia, the United States is keen on supporting African development priorities and fostering a mutually productive relationship with the continent. Joseph Sani, Vice President of the Africa Center at the U.S. Institute of Peace, told me on Encounter that U.S. partners would do well to strongly support the 15 flagship projects of Africa 2063, the African Union's 50-year development roadmap, including the African Continental Free Trade Area.
So the bottom line here is that the 15 flagship projects in the AU 2063 agenda could constitute the basis of moving this partnership forward in concrete terms. I don't think African countries are coming here to listen to new pledges. I think they are looking for ways and concrete mechanism to realize the commitments that have already been made. doing the COP26, 27, and doing different conferences as well.
Joseph Sani speaking about the U.S.-Africa Leaders Summit. And that's Encounters Look Back at 2022. Thanks to Rick Pantaleo for producing this year-end edition of the program. I'm Carol Castiel. From all of us at the Current Affairs Programming Desk at VOA, here's wishing you all a very happy and healthy new year.